All right, I am here with Stanislav. How are you doing?
Good, good.
Where can people follow you?
It's almost a sunny day today.
Okay. Well, here is
a little rain.
Here is raining, actually, a little bit, but still hot, but a little bit of rain. It feels good. Anyway, where can people follow you?
Moscow climate comes in weeks at a time. Climate changes. Okay. Don't let the heat wait. It's got to get cold and rainy, and then maybe you get some heat again. On X at Stanis Krapivnik. Couldn't fit the whole name. Substack, Zmei Garenich. Telegram, the American channel, or the English channel, rephrase that, the English language channel, Stas was there. The Russian language channel is Stas Udai Abratna. On YouTube, it's at Mr. Slavic Man, all one word, Slavic with a K. And my faux pas there, the American channel. There was a question in Quorum. I don't know if you know what Quorum is. Yeah, you know, Quorum. And somebody, asked this question. Hey, why don't the British have their own language? Like, you know, we speak English. Why don't the British speak British? Public education, man.
It's the internet. It's the internet, yeah. All right. let's talk about what's happening with the conflict in Ukraine. We had big strikes from Russia. A couple of big strikes over the past few days into Kiev. We had big drone and HIMARS strikes into Russia, hitting Belgorod with HIMARS, hitting Kursk with HIMARS. They damaged a pipeline in Belgorod. They also targeted the airport as well. And then you have this mystery of a drone hitting the Omsk refinery, one of the largest oil refineries in Russia. It looks like from the video that we're talking about, a direct hit, maybe a lot of damage. Hard to know, but 2,500 kilometers or miles away from kilometers away from Ukraine. Mm-hmm. How does a drone make it that far? There are some analysts who claim that a drone would not be able to go that far, and that this must have been launched from a country nearby. Some people are pointing to Kazakhstan. Other people are saying it was launched from somewhere inside of Russia. Anyway, should we begin with the Ukraine attacks, or should we start with the Russian attacks into Kiev?
No, we can begin with the Ukraine attacks. List of some of the plans hit for later. The drones, look, there was a discussion. I don't know if it ever went past a discussion in the administration. There was an article on it to set up chains of radar stations. Because here's the problem. Russia is huge. I mean, Russia is the biggest nation in the world. It's got gigantic borders with Kazakhstan. It's got huge borders. The conflict in Ukraine is over 1,000 kilometers long. It's got the biggest borders in the world with Kazakhstan of any country, between any two countries. And the problem is Russia is not flat, obviously. Chunks of it are. But it's forested. It's got hills, mountains, valleys, and so on. So there's places that you can get through, especially if you've got American satellite information coming in and doing topographical scans of the area. So the proposal was to set up radar towers in chains. You don't need to put an expensive radar system on there. A cheap radar system goes about 20 kilometers out, and about every 18, and then you have one tower that goes 20 kilometers out, and 38 kilometers out you have another tower, so they overlap a little bit and so on. And you spread these towers in rows up and down the Russian border so that you stop. Well, you don't stop, but you at least notify if something small is flying through, something like, say, a missile or a drone. Now, these drones that are flying deep, just understand, a lot of people are mixing types of drones up. What you normally see on videos is these Quadro drones, these little drone, plastic drones. Some of them are actually relatively big. They may be a meter wide, maybe a little bit bigger. But that's what most people think of as the drones, those drones that carry grenades to drop or are carrying an RPG round attached to them to blow something up. The drones we're dealing with here are airplane-type drones, and a lot of them, they're built in the in Europe. I mean, let's begin with that. Ukraine may be slapping them together. It may be providing some of the components, but the vast majority of these drones are built in Europe. The drones that murdered the 21 teenagers and injured, and some injured and turned into invalids, 40 others in Starobielsk, where I was at last week. Those were made in Italy because, you know, the Italians aren't smart enough if you're going to fight a war not to stamp made in Italy on everything. And that's stamped on the engine parts and everything made in Italy, product of Italy. So that alone should have been Casabella to strike that plant with a Reshnik and let the Italians know they've overstepped. That's absolutely Italy is now part of is a terrorist enabling state. Just like most of Europe are terrorist states. They enable terrorism, create terrorism, fund terrorism. But these drones are big. A lot of these drones get to be 4 meters in length. So they're carrying a lot of fuel. There's only three things on that drone, well, plus the guidance unit. That's the engine, the explosive package, and the fuel. The thing is when they get that deep in, luckily they're not carrying a large explosive charge because it's all fuel to get that far in. But they are getting that far in. And again, that's because Russia is just giant. And there's areas you can sneak in. So could the drone have flown that far through? Theoretically, yes. But just as equally, it may have flown out of Kazakhstan. And yeah, I doubt it flew from inside of Russia. The smaller drones that, like the one that hit, the Kremlin at the very beginning, there was a Quadro drone. Yeah, I'm pretty damn sure that was launched somewhere on the outskirts of Moscow. Cause those things, especially back then in, 22, those things really didn't have that much of a range on them. The battery packs were much smaller. It's amazing how fast everything, has advanced in drone warfare. So that the one that got shot down right above the Kremlin, that was probably launched from somewhere from Russia because they only had about a 20-30 kilometer range. These drones have huge ranges on them. Again, they're airplane-sized drones. There, some of them get to be the size of small Cessnas, and they're just on autopilot. So yeah, technically, yeah, they could have flown that far in. And yes, it could have come from Kazakhstan. I don't deny that as a possibility at all. The Kazakhs are trying to play a triple game there. Between their on the one side, they can't piss Russia off too much because without Russia, there is no Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan ceases to be a nation the moment Russia says, go screw yourself. Because Russia, what was going to happen to Kazakhstan, for people to understand it, Kazakhstan has a population of about 16 million people. It's almost 5,000 kilometers from end to end, east to west. It's empty, but lots of resources. Out of those 16 million people, 6 million of them plus change are Russians and Russian Germans. The rest are Kazakhs. The northern, particularly northern, northeastern Kazakhs are fully Russianized. A lot of them are Orthodox Christians. They can't stand the Kazakhs from the southwest. I've spent a lot of months in Kazakhstan working on different projects. And I was director of supply chain for Eurasia. For Halliburton, I had big offices in Kazakhstan, so I know that country pretty, that territory pretty well. On the flip side, south of Kazakhstan, you've got Uzbekistan that's looking at those gas oil fields at Tengiz greedily. That's 44 million people right there. Then you've got Tajikistan with claims on Kazakhstan with another 9 million, and Kyrgyzstan with claims. And then you got China coming in eastern Kazakhstan, edging its way in with claims from 2,000 years ago. Over chunks of eastern Kazakhstan. So Kazakhstan exists only because Russia hasn't let it go. If Russia grabs the north, everybody else will grab their chunks. There won't be a Kazakhstan in a week. It's physically impossible to defend that country with a population, a loyal to this regime population of maybe 7-8 million people. It's physically just impossible. But they're also playing, they have their money in London, the elites. They remind Russia saved them from an American-sponsored color revolution. Back in 21 that everybody forgets about. They forgot about it real quick. And then their money is also in London. So they've got, you know, three ways pulling them. three different masks, three different sides are trying to keep their trying to keep their arses on. So that you've got that. So yeah, absolutely could come from there. The big thing was Zelensky's attempt to hit Moscow again. It was very important for Zelensky to show something. Yesterday, he sent about 420 drones into Moscow. Something like 36 of them got into Moscow province, and none of them got into the outskirts of Moscow itself. So the systems, the anti-aircraft systems in that portion of Russia have been beefed up quite a bit. But again, these towers would do a lot to help, particularly in the southern border areas. Flying over the Caspian areas and so on, because just Russia is just that huge, and you need them also for Finland, because Finland is now an absolute enemy nation. Its leadership is hell bent on war, which will leave nothing alive in Finland. But they seem to be cool with that, and they seem to be hell bent on they've ruined their economy. They were a success as a neutral power. Their economy was absolutely tied to Russia. Their economy is in total collapse. It was, their number one import was wood products, that they were buying wood from Russia. That was their oil empire in Finland. That was the wood empire. That's gone. Their tourism is gone. Finnair was the premier aviation company in Europe at its time, mainly because it flew across Russia to Asia, and it was the hub to fly into Russia. Now they're begging people to buy or even take away their Boeings because they can't afford it. They're bankrupt. Everything in Finland is pretty much a bankrupt except the military. But so is Finland helping? Absolutely. Finland is helping the Ukrainians. Go ahead.
We know this. Mm-hmm. We know that Finland is helping. We know that helping. It's a very...
Yeah, that's my way to put.
Anyway, let's go with that word, helping. We know that Finland is helping. We know that the Baltics are helping. We know that the United States is helping. The Financial Times put out an article just the other day talking about how the United States is providing all of the targeting and the flight paths, everything. And that's why the drones are making it into Russia. That's why the missiles are making it into Russia, because it's the United States that's mapping everything out. We know this, and we know that Trump is not trying to put the brakes on Ukraine or Zelensky. Trump is on record. If you go by the media reports, and I don't see why these reports would be inaccurate in this instance, but they have Trump on record telling Zelensky at various meetings, including the G7, to go harder.
Yep.
To go harder and to keep on hitting Russia harder. Alexander Stubb told the Financial Times in an interview the other day that they're going to also support Ukraine to hit Russia harder and with longer range missile strikes. We know all this. If we know all of this, the Kremlin knows all of this, and Putin knows all of this. So the million-dollar question is, what is Putin doing? I mean, after 4 years plus, we finally saw some Russian pushback by going harder into Kiev. They've been avoiding Kiev for the 4 years of the SMO. They've been avoiding a lot of things for the SMO. You still have comments from Peskov where he is going after the Europeans, blaming everything on the Europeans, while avoiding to put any blame on the Trump administration. And just yesterday, he was talking about how Trump is open to listen to Russia's point of view. He's saying this. Trump is open to listen to Russia's point of view as the Trump White House is sending HIMARS and drones into Russia. So that's to me, that is the big question that everyone is trying to figure out. And everyone is trying to figure it out. And I've heard all the theories. I've read all the theories. I've heard all the theories. What is the Kremlin doing? What kind of a weird war is this that the Kremlin is engaging in?
I I haven't been getting invited in a lot of Russian television over the last month and a half. It's been falling off anyways, because I kept telling the truth about Trump. And you know, you're not supposed to criticize Trump. I'll say exactly what he is. You know, I from 23 on, when the first Heimers appeared, I was telling them, like, look, those are Americans. Behind the wheel are Americans. They may be sheep dipped into mercenaries, but it's from start to end, from the manufacturer of the missile and the manufacturer of the Heimers truck itself, to picking targets, to launching missiles, to guiding those targets in, it's Americans from start to end murdering Russian civilians. And everyone's looking at me, even on Russian television, they're all looking at me very oddly, to put it mildly. And then the New York Times in December of 24 comes out with this big article and explains, yes, it's Americans. And in fact, the attack of missiles weren't something Ukrainians were asking for. It's American generals were asking for, demanding them, and so on and so on. So, yes, we know this. In fact, I'll take it one step further. Lexus and Volvo and Lexus, they are the two prankers. I won't call them prankers. They are some of the best intelligence assets Russia has. Because, and you know, I was on their show. They actually have a show, and they discuss their various talks. And I asked them, I was like, dude, how do you get these people to just spill the beans? Like, we don't do anything. We just start talking to them. They want to tell everybody. They're like the villains out of James Bond. They want a monologue, how genius they are, how great they are, and they want the world to know. But these guys, they called the defense minister of Estonia. I mean, he spilled the beans in detail about how, yeah, they're doing everything
an advisor.
Okay.
To the Estonian government. So he wasn't, just to be on record, he wasn't an appointed government official.
Okay. I thought he was.
I know the call you're talking about.
Yeah.
But he did. He did say, yeah, as an advisor, someone close to the government. You're right. He did say some interesting
stuff. Yeah, we're doing everything we can to help the Ukrainians strike Russia. So Estonia is a direct enemy nation participating in this conflict. So is Finland. You know, the ones that are now actually walking back from that are the Poles, because apparently they got one Nazi too many from the Ukrainian side. And Melnik was just a bridge too far.
That's a whole
other
video.
Which is, by the way, why all of a sudden everybody's screaming, oh, the Russians are going to attack into Poland from Kaliningrad, because the Poles are going way off. So we know this. Why this is happening, why, you know, Russia started a strike Kyiv. That's true. And it's striking Kyiv every day to every 2 days, and big strikes. So that's true also. I mean, Kyiv is a big location. It's a city of almost 3 million people. It's pretty widespread in an open area. So they have a lot of military industrial complexes. They're questionable why they haven't been struck before. A lot of these facilities should have been struck 2 years ago. Definitely a year ago, as drones started to become an issue, long range drones. But they're now being struck. Okay. But again, it was very clearly stated, that they're only going to go after the military, decision-making centers, not the civilians, the government civilian, centers. Again, why? I don't know. Anybody says they do, they don't. It's very cross signals coming out of the Kremlin. It's very hard to read, and they'll go. It's two steps forward, one step back. Two steps forward, one step back. And there's different factions. You can tell there's different factions. The hardline factions, which by the way includes, Lavrov, who's sick and tired of all this, and who's by the way been just like Rubio, has been cut out of these so-called talks. I don't give these talks any credence. You've got American finance guys from both sides talking to each other. And none of them have appointed positions in their governments.
What is the strategy that you believe the Kremlin is employing, or is there no strategy?
Has
Putin bought into? Is Putin playing some sort of 10, 20, 30D chess with Trump? Is he stringing Trump along? Is he doing some sort of judo maneuver where he is allowing the opponent to use up all their resources before he strikes back? Or is, because I've heard all I've heard and read all of the analysis on the maneuvers that Putin is up to, or is Putin just Putin? And I mean, what I mean by that is he the Russian leader who, over the last 10, 15 years, just continues to fall prey to the West's charm, for lack of a better word, right? Whether it's Minsk and one,
stretching that word to the edges.
yeah, exactly. We're being very diplomatic in our use of words. It is YouTube. Whether it's falling for Minsk one, whether it's falling for Minsk two, whether it's falling for Istanbul 2022, you know, you name it, over and over and over again. Whether it's falling for Alaska. Is this just, should everyone just accept that this is just Putin? He's Western oriented and he continues to want to deal with the West. I mean, which one is it? I don't know. I'm asking you your thoughts.
He is Western oriented. He is a conservative liberal. If you understand that, he is, on the conservative cultural side, there are much, much more conservative forces, at play. I'm not going to say he's a neoliberal of the Western sort, but he's a conservative liberal. It is what it is. Why, you know, I can understand why Russia didn't go in 2014, because straight up the Russian economy would have been crushed. It was in no way, no position ready to go. And 22 was in a much stronger position. It had been strengthened. Putin's government did a lot to prepare that. Problem two is, though, they didn't do enough to prepare the public. So there was a lot of the public couldn't understand why all of a sudden now we're at war. Because for up to 2022, the conflict in Ukraine, for the majority of the population of Russia, was something over there. That you know, people like myself sent help to, and others went to volunteer to fight for, but it was something over there. It wasn't something that directly touched anybody. Yeah, some sanctions and things like that, but it wasn't anything too serious. So when this conflict started, a lot of people straight up did not understand why. It had to be explained in detail. So, and unfortunately, the Russian government is very bad at marketing. It's very bad at marketing. RT, other channels like that, they do a pretty decent job, but they're already starting from far behind and they're trying to catch up. So there's a lot of ground to cover compared to with the West. That, you know, the Western Russophobia had never stopped. If you look at some of the statements coming in the mid 90s, was the Russians, the evil Russians, may be coming back, and they'll charge all over Europe and all this. So it never really stopped. So from that point of view, the love affair with the West, I think that's a generational thing at this point. That generation. It's not going to let go of the love affair with the West. Yeah. My generation here is got a more realistic view of what the West brings you, because that's a generation that grew up in the 90s and saw the ruins and the destruction and everything else, and then the recovery. So I think there's also a generational factor here at play. And the generation before that, the Yeltsin generation, was much more in love with the West, for one reason or another. I mean, look at Gorbachev, Yeltsin, and the rest of that crew. So I think we've got an issue here with that.
Is there a strategy behind?
I don't know. Putin's at this point,
maximum restraint. I call it a policy.
It's a policy.
It's not a policy. And I know it's not a policy, but I call it a policy, for lack of a better.
It seems to actually be a policy.
Maximum restraint? Is there a strategy to maximum restraint?
Play defense on the drones and continue to advance on the battlefield. Yeah. That's as best as I can explain it. I mean, the military wants a large offensive. That's a gimme. There's over 350,000 troops sitting in reserve. Most of them have already been bloodied because there's a rotational program going on. You know, you put up a battalion, you push a battalion up to the front for 6 months. They get the combat experience. They rotate back for rest and relaxation and reorganization. You pull the push the next battalion up, and so on and so on. So the vast majority of troops are bloodied. They know how to fight. The reality of it, they're not green. But there's 350,000 extra troops just sitting there. Now, a lot of people are saying, just wait till the election September, everything is going to change. You know, Russia needs to do things like reinstate Smirch, the counterintelligence organization to fight spies and traitors. That's something that worked very, very well in World War II, because you see this, you see these kids that are getting, or not just kids, every day to day, somebody's getting arrested who's working for Ukrainian intelligence. And to be truthful about it, the majority of them aren't Ukrainian refugees. There are those too, some. The majority aren't Ukrainian refugees, and they're doing it for pennies that they'll never receive anyways. So you got that issue because you've got massive psyops working from that side, manipulating children, doing teenagers, and so on. So you've got to strengthen internally. And then just the military side of it, the military wants a big offensive. And I think at this point in time, if they launched a big armored offensive, sure, you would carry high casualties the first couple of days, but you would be able to punch through any of these lines and punch deep. Ukraine does not have the aviation capacity to stop it. Drones only work so well when the front is rolling on top of you. Drones work great when the front's barely moving or moving very slowly, because you can get drone operators up there. They can get those FPV drones up and so on. But if the front is a dynamic front, most of those operators are never going to last long, because they've got to get close enough to the front. And that's something that's going to be very difficult. But then again, we're still going the same way. I don't think there's going to be any kind of big summer offensive that everybody was predicting. Okay. I think that's a fantasy just like last year.
Yeah, I think I got your answer. Putin is Putin, and that's the way it's going. And we shouldn't expect any changes from Putin. He is who he is, a man of his time, his generation, which has a certain leaning towards the West. It's going to be difficult to change that.
I think if you get people like Medvedev in, I think there'd be a Medvedev went from being somewhat liberal, or maybe that was an act. I don't know. The people that I've talked to that know him personally said, no, what you see right now is the real Medvedev, at least the real Medvedev that is now the Medvedev. So,
well, there's no doubt, like you said, there's no doubt there's a group of hardliners. I would say the majority are hardliners. And then you have this small contingent of let's say soft guys who would prefer to appease the Trump administration in the belief that certain big deals are going to come out of it. This is what they believe. So that seems to be the policy that Putin continues to lean towards. You are starting to see the strikes into Kiev ramp up, and that's my. Yes. And then my next and final question to you, so you could wrap up the video, is to take us through what Russia has been doing over the past couple of weeks. They're going after the fuel stations in Ukraine. They hit 37 fuel stations just last week, making it very difficult for logistics and supply lines. They've captured Konstantinovka. They're going to capture Lyman. Kiev, the capital city, is being hit whenever, however, wherever Russia wants. And you do have an open admission now from the Ukrainians that they are able to intercept zero missiles that are heading towards Kiev. So anyway, your thoughts to wrap the video on everything that is happening on the Russian side of things.
Okay, so obviously Konstantinovka has fallen, even though Reuters told us at the beginning of last week that Russian troops are just now getting up to the edges of Konstantinovka. They must have meant the northern edges of Konstantinovka. Look, Krasnoyarsk's fallen too. It hasn't been announced yet. They're basically doing cleanup operations, taking out whatever pockets of Ukrainian resistance are left. What that gives you, it gives you a pincer movement from both sides up and down this arc of Druzhinka, Kramatorsk, Slavinsk. Russian forces are about 5 to 7 kilometers east of all three of those cities, too, as they're moving up. And from Dobropolye, DNR, there's a spike going up that's moving up behind Drzhovka and Kramatorsk. And Konstantinovka, it was that gate that allows you to go start going around them as well as up the road, up the direct, up their throat. So that is the last big base fortress area. Behind that is mostly open fields, small villages, some field fortifications. The key thing for the Ukrainians here, unlike the previous 4 years of this conflict in this area, is there's nothing behind them to fall back onto. It's open fields, small unprepared villages all the way to the Dnieper. So every Ukrainian soldier sitting there, well, for earlier they could always fall back to the next line, the next line. Chasiv Yar was taken, they fall back to Mirograd, or they could fall back to Konstantinovka. They've always something back behind them that's already prepared and they can go fall back and it's more line. There's nothing left after this. It's open fields. So if they stay too long, they're dead. If they run too fast, too early, they're dead. Either way, there's no good option for anybody left in there. They stay too long, they get into a double envelopment plus a pincer movement and a head-on assault on top of that, and their lines. God, and that's the other problem for them is try getting logistics in across those open lines. Russia has air dominance. Russia has drone dominance in that area. You can't get supplies in. I mean, you've got 20, 30,000, maybe 50,000 men in that area. You got to feed them pretty well. You got ammunition goes fast. And if they wait too long and the rainy season kicks in, then they're gone. There's no escaping that either. You know, try running across or getting across 200 kilometers of open areas with very small villages to try to stop off. And you can't hold them because those villages don't form any kind of line. They're just random villages, the way villages pop up. They just go around them and take them out with second echelon troops. So that's a big problem for them in that area. Russian troops are about 5 kilometers out, and the DRGs, the reconnaissance and sabotage units, are already in the edges of Sumy. They're going down a forested area to the northeast of Sumy. That saves them from drone reconnaissance and from drone strikes. It's a heavy forest. And by the way, while I'm at it, there's reports of Russian DRG units already inside of Kramatorsk, Drzhovka, and Slavinsk. And once you fully consolidated in Krasny Liman, so Slavinsk is about 15 kilometers southwest. And it's an open area. So, Krasny Liman is on high ground, which is, by the way, in 1944, how that whole area was taken. The Red Army came through that exact same route, because you went from high ground to low ground. Artillery has much greater range. And one branch of that is going to go off, to Izum, and retake Izum. So that's a collapse of logistics. That's a collapse of the entire area. Now, there's rumor that, I don't know, nobody seems to know particularly. There's lots of rumors flying around that Shuravikin, General Armageddon, is going to be brought back in to run the Kherson and Zaporozhye fronts for retaking those areas. And look, again, two steps forward, one step back. There was talk about we're going to liberate all of Novorossiya. Then there's like, well, you know, but you know, we're sticking to our objectives. So it's hard to tell. There's crossing lines of thought there and signals. But if we're talking about all of Novorossiya, that's Chernigov, that's Sumy, that's Kharkov, Poltava, Dnipropetrovsk, Nikolaev, and Odessa. That's basically both sides of the Dnieper River, and depending on who you ask, that's Kyiv included, because Kyiv is absolutely a Russian city. So there's that. How long will the Poles hold off? That's a big question, too, especially the way relations are going, and especially since groups like the terrorist organization that's now a core called Azov, they published their flag of Greater Ukraine, which includes a third of Poland. You know, now they're threatening to start murdering Poles. So, you know, if the Kyiv government eventually collapses, what's going to happen next from Kyiv's neighbors in the West? I think there's going to be a land grab. I mean, sure, I'm sure they're not going to call it a land grab. They'll talk about, you know, setting up a protectorate to defend Polish citizens, which there's a lot of, because Poland's been given out Polish citizenship and Polish cards, kind of green cards to anybody that can show any ancestry with Poland for several decades now. And Hungarians have been just giving out citizenship left and right. So that'll be an interesting thing how that unfolds. But that's I think, the reality in that direction. Now, having said that, just the last 2 days, 3 days, the strikes in the Kyiv. And you're right, 2 days ago, the strikes were about 420 aviation platforms, out of which 68 were missiles, a couple of Zircons, hypersonics. The vast majority were regular ballistic missiles. I can't believe I just forgot the name of it. Oh,
Iskanders,
that's not good.
Iskanders, Kaliber.
Thank you, Iskanders. The total brain fart. Yeah, the majority of Iskanders, third generation, second generation Iskanders, none of them been intercepted. And Kyiv's admitted, as you said, Kyiv admitted it. The Garands, you've now seen the fourth generation Garands that also carry anti-aircraft missiles. Ukraine just lost a helicopter that was trying to shoot down a Garand drone that shot it down with the loss of all crew. And they've admitted to that. They put a necro log of all four members of the helicopter that was trying to shoot down this Garand drone. So, you know, the Garand drones are now having missile carriers as well as being able to strike targets. So this is getting very, very complicated very, very quickly for the Ukrainians and for the NATO people in the area. So these are the plants, just a quick rundown of facilities that were hit over the last 3 days in Ukraine. And if you watch the videos, there's a lot of fireworks. There's a lot of secondary explosions and things flying in every direction for up to a kilometer. So all of those Ukraine's trying to claim as, you know, Russian strikes on civilian buildings. Oh, no, they're not. In fact, there's even photos that came out with some Garands with parachutes on them. So if they get knocked down, they come down on a parachute so they don't blow anything up below them, i.e. civilian buildings. And by the way, what I'm calling the Raytheon roulette, we've seen the remaining Patriot missiles, as has been the tendency, and the tendency that came out back even in Saudi Arabia when they were trying to take out Yemeni's Tochka Uz, that about 1 in 6, 1 in 8 Patriots decides to pick its own targets. Usually find some building it falls in love with and strikes it. I've seen one video out of Saudi Arabia where the Patriot missile just took a 90-degree turn and took out the building just below the balcony of the guy that was filming the launches from two buildings away. So we continue to see that Patriot missiles that just decide on their own which way they're going to go and find a target of their own. So a lot of damage just from that. But the buildings, the facilities that Russia's hit, we've got, for example, Kyiv 71. These are from yesterday. Kyiv 71 is a drones and optics equipment manufacturer. Kyiv 1 is a drones and radar equipment manufacturer. Kyiv 79 is an armored vehicles and munitions manufacturer. That had a lot of secondary explosions. Kyiv shipyards, because Kyiv's on the Dnieper, of course. And Kyiv 1 instrument manufacturing plant. So this is your machining. This is machining and machine parts plant. Then you've had 3 days ago, you had LLC Radionics, which developed guidance systems for the Flamingo. Athlon Avra LLC Scientific Production Company, drone manufacturer. Antonov Serial Production Airplane, which they're not doing any of, but they're doing lots of drones. The airplane size drones, the 4-meter drones. Kyiv Radio Plant, that's sighting systems for armored vehicles, first and foremost, but also components for drones, optical components for drones, radar drone, both for reconnaissance drones and for targeting kamikaze drones. Kyiv 25, that's a hardware storage manufacturer, so for your hard drives and software that goes along with it that are used in electronic warfare equipment. And the Chaika Logistics Center, which was fully destroyed. That was also a key logistical component. As far as the gas stations, this is a little bit different. They're not hitting gas stations in Kyiv. They're hitting gas stations as part of a effort to stop launches of drones into Russia, because the tactic that Kyiv or that NATO, let me rephrase that, let's be honest about it. The tactic that NATO adopted was they're taking these light trucks called Gazelles. They're mostly running either diesel or gasoline, either one. And light trucks with a box back end, and they're putting two drones in each, driving them up as close as they can to the contact line, and they're launching two drones out, and off they shoot and scoot, or launch and scoot in this case. And they're off somewhere. Good luck trying to find these trucks. And they're using hundreds of these trucks to launch hundreds of drones. They drive up, reload, refuel. Well, since finding them is hard, particularly because they hide them in garages, they're relatively small trucks. They hide them in the garages. They hide them under buildings and so on in parking lots. But they are fueled by local gas stations or local petrol stations. That's where Russia started going after the petrol stations. There's been 600 petrol stations taken out in the Sumy, Kharkov, Chernigov area. And they continue to just destroy one petrol station after the other within about 100 kilometers, 150 kilometer range of Russia itself, and moving further in as you start running out of targets. So it's not every petrol station. That would be pointless. It's concentrated closer to the front to deny fuel capabilities for all these trucks that are coming in and out launching the drones. And that's the situation right now. Their drones, you know, I was in I just got back from Donbass last Tuesday. The situation there is dangerous. It's very dangerous because you've got Palantir drones. And let's just be frank, Thiel is a war criminal and a terrorist. The way his drones run, they're fire-and-forget drones. These Hornets, first 80% of the charge, they're looking for something that looks military. Last 20% of the charge, they're looking for anything that moves. So there's been a lot of civilian cars hit up and down these roads. The Russian armies reacted to this, adapted to this by making Mad Max gun cars. They've taken the light vans like the Bukhanka. They've taken hatchback cars, taken out the hatchbacks, mounted a gun point on there, basically made technicals. Out of them, or pickup trucks, putting medium machine guns on them, and they escort all the trucks, all the military trucks, and they run patrols up and down the roads. They're very good at taking out these drones. The drones aren't fast, but they're fast enough you're trying to take a truck out, especially on a curvy road. So these, it's an effective tactic, and then one that's been adopted up and down Donetsk and Lugansk, anywhere you drive. The unfortunate part is there's enough of them for escorting military equipment. There's not really enough of them for civilian cars. Civilian cars are on their own. And they have been the number one target for the Ukrainians. That's the unfortunate part. A lot of civilians have been killed on the roads over the last couple of months. And we see them continue to strike buses, particularly buses from Belarus. Those seem to have become their favorites.
All right. Thanks for the update, Stanislav. Where can people follow your work?
Okay. So Zmei Garenich is my Substack. Telegram, Stas Tuda I Obratna, is the Russian one. Stas Was There is the English one. At Mr. Slavic Man, all one word, Slavic with a K, on YouTube. And on X, Stanis Krepivnik. Just up to the S and then Krepivnik. Couldn't fit the whole name in.
Those links in the description box down below. Thanks. Take care.
Yep.